Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. The subject of this episode is the future of local government, or to put it another way, is your council about to go bust? Should you be worried? And what should be done about it? My guests today to explore this question are Professor Tony Travers from the London School of Economics, and Emily Andrews and Martin Wheatley from the Institute of Government. Welcome to you all. Emily, let's start with you. Give us a sense as to the nature and shape of austerity, as it's been referred to, has been called, since 2010. You know, when we think about the public services landscape, what's been happening over that eight-year period?
So I run a project called Performance Tracker, which looks at nine key public services and what has changed in terms of spending on those services, but also what's changed in terms of what we, the public, get for that money. So we cover hospitals, schools, adult social care, children's social care, neighbourhood services, prisons, police, criminal courts. So we don't cover the whole of the public sector, but we've got all the kind of the big ticket ones there. And what our analysis tells us is that all of those services have faced some kind of financial squeeze over this period. Not all of them have had their spending cut. GPs, hospitals, for example, have seen spending rise. It's the same in schools. But of course, if demand is rising faster, then that creates a financial pressure. Now, schools have probably fared the best in terms of the financial squeeze over the last 8 years. But over the last 3 years, there has been a drop in per pupil spending. So they've had to manage that. They've had to bridge that gap between spending and demand somehow. And what our analysis also shows us is that in all of those services, efficiencies were made. So they all managed to get more out of the money that they had. But they didn't do this by making the services fundamentally cheaper to run. Instead, the government relied on what we call kind of short-term belt-tightening measures. So that's wage control, the notorious pay cap, and also cutting staff and asking them to do more. We're now at the point where both of those tactics have either reached or are reaching the end of the road. Of course, the pay cap has been somewhat eased, if not lifted. That creates new costs for services. But also the other strategy that's been used to make savings, which is asking staff to do more, is also looking increasingly unsustainable. We're seeing rising vacancy rates in hospitals and in social care. Number of GPs is falling, and it's fallen consistently since 2015. We're having a harder time recruiting and retaining teachers, particularly in certain subjects. Prison officers, no problem recruiting prison officers. Last year we recruited 3,000. That's incredible, but 5,000 prison officers left. So real retention issues there. And that means kind of trying to get more out of staff. That's going to be a risky strategy. So the question is, what's the government going to do next? It's not about to get any easier. Demand for all of these services is set to rise in most of these cases faster than it has done over the last 8 years. But what we've seen is a real lack of plan from government about what comes next. Obviously, there's some really tough decisions to be made. So sure, we could get some further efficiencies, but they almost been pushed as far as they can go. So the future's going to have tax rises, maybe, or it's going to have more co-payment, and we've already seen a bit more of that already in the last 8 years, or maybe people are going to have to accept a bit less out of public services. And those tough choices, I think, haven't really been surfaced in the public debate, and local government has been particularly affected by these things. I'd say it's at the sharpest end of those problems, which are kind of all across the public sector, and I think it's what happens next on local government finances is going to be an interesting test case for where this goes next.
Well, we'll get on to the local government in a second, but Tony, your sense is to, you know, just the global reaction to the nature and shape of the austerity programme that we've seen since 2010?
Well, I mean, first, I'd like to say that the performance tracker the Institute for Government publishes is wonderful. I can say that more easily than your other two guests. And what it's helped us understand is the fact that, you know, austerity has gone on for far longer than was ever intended. You know, remember back in 2010, George Osborne, the Chancellor, intended the deficit to be gone by 2015. Well, here we are at the end of 2018, and you know, the deficit's going to linger on into the 2020s and possibly even longer if there are bigger pressures on public finances. So what started out as a short, sharp process, or sharpish process, has become effectively the norm forever. And that creates a real challenge for the UK government, which has got, as in other matters we're not discussing today, a number of inconsistent pressures bearing down on it. So it wants to reduce the deficit to zero, it wants to reduce the national debt, which is up to nearly 90% of GDP, but it's now, you know, Theresa May at the Conservative Party conference recently said that austerity might come to an end. Now, how you do all of these things, oh, and not put taxes up, because most Conservative MPs don't want to put taxes up, you know, in a sense, there just aren't any options by the time you've closed off all of those ways out. So local government, which is what often we're here to talk about today, though I think Emily's absolutely right to point out that there are other parts of the public sector that have been squeezed just as much. And you know, one of the things I took out of the last year's performance tracker is the idea that the government cuts some services till they fail and then chucks money at them. Such a bad way of doing something, you know? So we've seen that with prisons, we've seen it with adult social care. You know, questionable at some point we see it for local government. We're sitting in a room facing a copy of one of the local government periodicals whose front page headline over there is "Surrey, you're broke." And I realise that Surrey isn't a city, but you know, the truth is that local government, in common with other parts of the public sector, can be reduced. Can have, as Emily says, can have its spending reduced up to a point, but there comes a point, a tipping point, where you think, well, either it has to do less, and ministers have to take the brave step of saying, no more libraries, well, just imagine any politician saying that, they won't, or taxes have to go up. Now, interestingly, in the last few years, ministers have accepted taxes going up in local government, the so-called precept for adult social care and a little bit extra for police. So that's nibbling away at the idea of no tax rises. I mean, but you know, we're on the edge of the budget. It'll be interesting to see how Philip Hammond signals the future for tax policy now, because I think that is the most likely place for things to give if there is to be a bit more money in the intermediate future to allow local government to escape what is, you know, currently a simply a one-way street to flat cash funding forever.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, Martin, anything to add in terms of the sort of global nature of the austerity programme or process that we've seen since 2010? And then we'll get into the local government set of questions and issues. Yeah,
I agree with everything Tony said. The direction I would take the conversation is to think about the dynamics of spending review and spending control processes in Whitehall and how they play out particularly with local government. Now, we published a report recently looking ahead to the next spending review and reviewing what had happened in 2010 and 2015. And what we find about spending reviews and the Treasury's approach to spending controls is it very much based on a set of bilateral haggles with departments led by a Secretary of State. There's an absence of strategy, a focus on getting numbers to add up on a spreadsheet rather than planning resource allocation effectively to meet the needs of a strategy. And local government comes out of this particularly uncomfortably for a number of reasons. First of all, of course, it's not a programme or department led by its own Secretary of State. We have MHCLG, but actually 13 Whitehall departments are in some way making decisions that bear on local government. Historically, MHCLG and its predecessors have not necessarily had the clout or capability within Whitehall to be an effective advocate for someone else. Of course, it is also an independent layer of government with its own elected political leadership, so it's not part of the government which is making decisions about its spending. Historically, it has had its own revenue sources, but of course they have only contributed very small degree of the funding it's spent. So if you overlay the austerity processes since 2010 over that particular set of dynamics about the relationship between Whitehall and local government, things start to happen, like secretaries of state who don't play the spending game in the classic way of trying to maximise resources for their programme, but indeed see their political advantage in putting forward bigger reductions than everyone else. Local government is, of course, also a multi-service entity.
Yeah.
So it becomes the residual of a whole series of other decisions, and through the austerity process, the government has shown, in my view, very little ability to come up with a strategic view about how local government as a whole should function and be funded.
Well, I think that's and we'll come to this. I wonder whether that's a bug of the system or a design in the system, which I increasingly think is, you know, it's part of the design. It's not a bug, and you can't deal with that. But so, Emily, you said a part of your opening, kind of local government particularly, but not exclusively, on the sharp end of budget reductions over that period. Can you just say a little bit more on that? And, I mean, the NAO have just had their report recently, which gives some eye-watering numbers in terms of, you know, real cash reduction and spending power and all the rest. But just say a little bit more about that. And then, because I'm quite keen to pick up on the services and the geography questions, because I think all of that matters.
So I think, I mean, you know, local government is kind of on the sharp end from two directions. And I think I'm going to be vaguely singing one of Tony's tunes here, where you've got, on the one hand, spending power has gone down, but they also have to deal with children's social care and adult social care, demand for which is going up. Children's social care in particular, actually. One of the most eye-watering statistics is that the number of, since 2009-10, the number of children who are where there's some kind of, where a group of social workers and other professionals get together to have a discussion about whether or not this child is at risk, that's doubled since 2010. You know, the number of looked after children has gone up something like 13%. That's intensive. You know, children's social care is incredibly expensive, and demand is rising, same in adult social care. So what that means is, of course, you know, those services are statutory, you have to provide them, and so some of the other things that local government does is getting squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. That's things like road maintenance, waste collection, libraries, training standards, parks, culture. And the difference between, of course, social care and those things is that a lot of those discretionary things, or they're not actually, a lot of them are statutory, but you've got a little bit more leeway how much you do, those are things that affect the environment that everyone lives in, right? All council taxpayers get the benefit of those services, whereas social care is targeted at a very, very small part of the population. So we're seeing kind of people, local taxes are going to a smaller and smaller group of people and less to the things that they really benefit from. And I think we're going to get to a point where people start noticing, they already are starting to notice. But one of the big problems, and I mean, on the one hand, this is a problem for me because I'm a massive data nerd, but I think it's also a problem for all of us, is that while we have quite a good idea in a lot of public services, particularly the NHS, there's tons of data. We know so much about the consequences of austerity on hospitals, for example. You know, we know so much about waiting times. There's so much data out there. With a lot of these neighbourhood services, these things that local government does, it's a bit more hidden what the consequences of spending reductions have been. And I mean, there's no question, I think, that local government has actually done a quite extraordinary job in managing to make genuine efficiencies and deliver more for less. But the problem is, from the viewpoint of Whitehall, they don't know how far that's true and how far services have just got worse or are not being delivered. So you're kind of driving to the edge of a cliff, but you don't know how far away the cliff edge is.
Yeah.
Now, on the one hand, you could say it's up to local government to know how close they are to the edge, for each council to know how close they are to the edge. You know, they're a tier of government, you know, they make decisions about their local area. But while we live in such a centralised system where Whitehall has a huge amount of power over how much money local government has to spend, I think it's quite damaging that they don't have a better sight of what the consequences of spending reductions have been, and so what a kind of reasonable quantum of funding might be.
Yeah, and just to give the in the NEO report, just to back up what you were saying there, Emily, they reckon a 3% real terms reduction in local authority spending on social care between 10-11 and 16-17, 33% real terms reduction in local authority spending on non-social care services, again, over that same period, 10-11, 16-17. So quite a significant, you know, ring fencing and safeguarding statutory responsibilities by slashing quite extensively a bunch of other things that actually matter. Tony?
Yeah, I mean, and that's, I don't think the government itself set out to do what's happened, which is they certainly set out to reduce the deficit at the national level, but then decided to protect a number of major and expensive services such as the NHS, particularly the triple lock on the state pension, which, you know, is now apparently with us forever. And once that had happened, it meant that other services, and among them local government, have been cut far further. But within local government, as Emily said, children's care and adult social care have to some degree been protected. And that means, as the National Audit Office, as you point out, Andrew, has itself shown in very helpful charts, and the IFG publication includes them too, services such as culture and libraries, environmental services have been cut by 40, 50, 60%. Now, these are the services people meet outside their front door. Everybody listening to this podcast will know when they leave their home tomorrow whether the streets are clean, whether there are holes in the road, whether the street lights are on, whether the libraries are still open. These are the things that, this is why cities invented all of these things in the 19th century, you know, talking at the centre of the cities. Cities created all of these things as part of their response to the growing cities during the Industrial Revolution. And these very services, public goods, are being cut furthest and fastest. Mm. And so had the government set out explicitly to make the place look a bit worse by cutting public spending, this would have been the way to do it. They didn't actually do that, but that's what they've ended up doing. And the difficulty with this, I think, the big P political difficulty for the current government is that they risk allowing the opposition, capital O, an open goal by saying, look around you. And I think the Conservatives are beginning to realise this, you know, after the last general election when austerity came up on the doorstep. But the difficulty is, and we're back to even bigger P politics now, because almost all the life's been sucked out of politics by Brexit, there is no policy about any of this.
No.
The government has no thinking space, and as the earlier mentioned National Audit Office have pointed out, you know, the capacity of central government, as Martin says, MHCLG, to plan for the future of local government is near zero.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, going to become a bigger political issue in the next 3, 4, 5 years. Yeah. And there'll be a general election in that period.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's another layer to the onion, then. It's not just about the balance between social care services and the more universal services in local government, but what's been going on within adults and children's services. During the research for the Spending Review project, I had a very disturbing conversation with the chief executive of a Northern Metropolitan Authority about children's services. And what that revealed was that there is a vicious spiral opening up with how money is spent within social care. In order to feed the machine of meeting statutory responsibilities for rising case referrals, the more universal end of the spectrum of social care services is being cut.
Mm.
The consequence of that, this chief executive feared, is just feeding the increase in caseload for the emergency responsive services further, on top of which other aspects of austerity, welfare cuts, reductions in other public services are also putting vulnerable families under more strain. And it comes back to my point about the absence of a strategic perspective in spending reviews and in the Treasury, that it is allowing these dynamics to develop, which are actually making the task of managing within limited budgets even more difficult. And I think the concern that I picked up from people in operational public services during my research is of a sense of disconnection between the Treasury and Whitehall and their world. That Whitehall doesn't even understand the way these dynamics are developing, let alone have the systems and, as you say, Tony, the headspace to try and work out how we move forward to a more sensible way of planning, spending and activity.
But it's interesting to hear, to agree with this, Anne Longfield, who's the Children's Commissioner, has become much more visible in public discourse in the last few months. And the reason for that is that, you know, she's obviously picking up many of the points Martin's just made. But I think, you know, also we're beginning to learn that whilst children's social care is working for the children who are currently getting it, it's very hard now to get new provision for those who do not. And that's a further issue. And, you know, it comes back again and again and again to the difficulty of Whitehall, as Emily said, understanding what's going on out there in this very large number of municipalities. And secondly, as I said earlier, not really understanding the concept of the tipping point.
No.
I mean, the concept of the tipping point is very important. And I think that, you know, if we were to give one piece of advice, or I would, one piece of advice to central government, is they're going to have to get their heads around this soon, because the risk is otherwise step-by-step systemic failure. And that won't look good.
No. And this, I mean, picks up you in the performance tracker. You don't quite do it, but the way that you talk about the way that services have responded is sort of two halves, really. The first half is you cut some money, but you carry on kind of doing the thing that you're doing. The second half, you know, as we get into, you know, 14 and 15 and 16, actually that's when, you know, the tipping point has probably been reached, where you simply can't carry on delivering what you've been delivering, just slightly, you know, cheaper or slightly more efficiently. Actually, it begins to really bite.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's kind of an interesting pattern if you line up some of our charts from different services next to each other, you know, from prisons and hospitals and adult social care. You do see everything looking kind of fine, and then a tipping point being reached in about 2013-14. But I think what we're starting to see now actually is some of the other services, you know, so there was clearly big problems in the run-up to the 2015 spending review, and what we saw then, as Martin says, was a kind of a lack of strategic thinking, a lack of acknowledgement about those pressures, so government just tried to do the same thing again and cut spending, and that's where we've seen those things get worse. And then, as Tony said, the response has been not just to an operational crisis. You know, there was a response, there's been responses to operational crises in hospitals and prisons, where the response was an emergency injection of cash, same thing with adult social care, but actually also in response to political crises. So in schools, for example, schools got an extra 1.3 billion last year because it's incredibly politically difficult to take money away from some schools to give it to others, which is what they were doing. But what I think is interesting, so we're now in this what we call the reactive spending cycle, right, where problems have been allowed to mount, and then all that can be done is chuck in some cash, which might allow you to carry on as you were before, but not necessarily to solve any of the underlying problems. Now we're at a position, I think, where we see two things happening. One is that some of the other services, I think, are starting to turn. I think maybe we might be reaching the police tipping point, whereas police, I think, we're managing for longer. What's really interesting in police is that actually the cuts to police kind of happened stopped a few years ago, and it's been flat, and there's something about kind of problems, you kind of reaping the problems later on and then kind of having to scramble to catch up with them. But I mean, we're now at a position where even when it's not an emergency cash injection, so, you know, this new long-term funding settlement for the NHS, right, that's not an emergency cash injection, that's a five-year settlement, right, and it's serious money. But even now, you know, that money can do one of two things, I think. It can either be used to kind of recover service standards, to keep up with demand, to kind of shrink waiting times, or it can be used to try and fundamentally change the way that we deliver these services and invest in them to make them different. I'm not sure that there's enough money there to do both. And that's the huge challenge facing the NHS. And, you know, and I think, you know, other services are looking in real envy at the NHS. You know, a lot of, you know, local government is quite angry about that, actually, and saying, you know, why don't they give it to us? Why don't they give it to social care, and that will ease pressures and we can spend the money so much better. But, you know, even that huge wedge of money, there's still going to be real tough decisions to be made.
Yeah. Tony, So you talked a little bit about different types of services, you know, crudely statutory, non-statutory, non-statutory, very, very big reductions. There also seems to be a pattern where certain types of authorities, metropolitan districts, as Martin already said, London boroughs, urban authorities, let me say that, seem to have been more adversely affected by austerity than non-urban authorities. Do you say something? I mean, and apart,
yes and no.
Is that deliberate or not?
Well, yes and no. If you, Martin very elegantly referred to the former Secretary of State's approach to public spending whilst at what was then called the Department of Housing and Local Government. I mean, the truth is that the way the government has gone about cutting public spending in local authorities started off with bigger reductions for urban authorities than for counties and rural ones. Mm-hmm. Though latterly, in fact, the policy went the other way slightly. But if you look at the earlier mentioned National Audit Office research, it's very clear that urban authorities have seen their spending fall fastest over the last 8 years, and shire rural ones less so. Now,
is that a political decision?
Well, at the time, what the Secretary of State said was that there was, as it were, proportionate cuts being made to the central funding of these councils. It's just that it had a bigger effect because the grants were bigger in urban ones than rural ones. I mean, you can argue till the cows come home whether that was fair or not. He obviously thought it was fair. But, and the reason I said yes and no is that, intriguingly, it is shire counties that are showing the greatest signs of stress. Mm-hmm. We all know about Northamptonshire. Now, you know, in fairness, Northamptonshire was, to some extent, the victim of its own failure to balance its budget. And there are clearly other counties feeling analogous stress on their budgets. And the reason for this is that social care, which we were talking about earlier, adults and children's, is a larger part of counties' budgets than it is metropolitan districts and London boroughs, simply because they have a wider range of services. So with that in mind, the question, we're now going to get on to the fair funding review. I can just feel that the fair funding got two things we haven't actually talked about yet, quite understandably. One is the spending review, the government spending review for the next 1 or 4 years. I'd like to ask my two colleagues here whether it's going to be 1 or 4 years. And then the fair funding review, which is due to come into effect, I think, in 2021, which is, you know, within local government analysis of, you know, equalisation and fairness and things. So with that in mind, I think given the amount of angst and worry that we've heard from counties, you know, the government is going to be under quite a lot of pressure, I think, to tilt the funding in the direction of the counties, simply because the way British public spending works, the more noise, the more trouble, the more difficulty you're in, the more likely you are to get money. Mm. That's a really odd way of doing it, but there we are.
Yeah.
Prisons fail, they get more money. And counties look as if they're having more trouble than urban authorities. I would guess that politicians will react to that by giving counties rather more of any money there is than urban authorities. Yeah. That's my first bad signal for the future for the centre of the cities.
Thank you very much, Martin.
Friends.
Thank you. I think so, to add to that perspective, but also I suppose, not to further complicate the situation, although I think it is important. You know, we talked about how local government public services have responded to austerity in terms of reductions and some productivity growth and things like that. We've also been reforming the way that local government gets funded and financed more generally in relation to business rates. We've opened up council tax precepts, some flexibility around that. We've definitely seen councils begin to use sales and charges much more for certain types of services. I think but you highlight that in the work as well. Just can you just give us a sense as to how kind of local government is responding to and reacting to, you know, reductions from central government funding and questions and issues around business rates and council. Big question, but because I think that's an important part of the story. It's not just about reducing government money to local authorities. There's also a play about changing the nature of the way that local authorities are funded more generally.
Yes, well, there are a number of strands there. As we've been discussing, the government has embarked on increasing the percentage of local government funding, which is locally raised, which is, of course, what the sector has been arguing for years. So it ought to be a good thing. There are two big buts, though, of course, which are this is happening at the time that grant is being cut and indeed increasingly being eliminated for authorities. And so it's not particularly if the amount of money that local government can raise through business rates and council tax remains constrained, it's not going to be a way out for the sector. I note a couple of things. First of all, that both these revenue sources are property taxes. And there is a bit of an issue about if you were designing a tax base for a tier of government, would you not, starting with a blank sheet of paper, be looking for a more diverse fiscal base for that layer of government than just property taxes? Secondly, there is a lot of pressure, which is in the classic British way being mediated on central government, not local government, to cut business rates because they are perceived to be having an adverse impact on high streets and so on. So local government remains at risk being highly dependent on these two fiscal sources. That central government will decide political reasons it wants to constrain or cut them, still showing no signs of a strategic view about whether local government should have flexibility, as municipalities do in almost any other OECD country, to widen their tax base in other ways. And it, although it's made a commitment on the migration from grant to local property taxes, alongside the uncertainty about the fair funding review, it has not set out with any degree of certainty what it sees as the future path for local taxes. So managing would be very, very hard for the sector if it had a clear financial framework going forward. But if, you know, even if it was very bad news in terms of the numbers, if it was clear, the sector would be in a better position than it is now. Now, turning to such silver linings as there are, one of the insights that I had from talking to people in the sector about public spending control and spending reviews was that in some places, at least, and maybe this is something to do with the difference of the relative success in weathering the storm of the Mets and some of the counties, that some councils have really fundamentally rethought the way they do financial planning in a way that we think has lessons for other public services, indeed for central government. And Simon Parker from Redbridge spoke very eloquently at our launch about how Redbridge is now not starting with the money, but starting with activity, and doing what in organisations with good financial management would be regarded as a sensible strategic way of planning resources. And I picked up other examples of that on my travels. So I think that is cause for optimism in two ways. First of all, if the government can actually get its act together in the spending review next year about local government finance and funding, provide a long-term framework, even if it's quite tough in terms of the numbers, I think there are the skills and processes in local government to make the best of it. But secondly, local government leaders see a real opportunity to apply these techniques and processes to the whole array of local public services in their place, where they see in the NHS and elsewhere that financial management is far more rudimentary and far less of a sense of financial control and discipline.
Yeah.
And I think an opportunity I would urge the government to seize in the next spending review is whether we can make more sense of the money that is spent on the whole array of local public services, including the bulk of spending, which is, of course, outside the local government envelope,
yes,
through harnessing the strong and resilient financial management that local government has begun to develop.
Mm. I mean, just to add to this point, local government's long been in the really awkward position that its very capacity to manage and mediate, as we've been discussing this morning, today, makes it easier to cut it more. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible signal, this, because the very fact that it does manage to deal with, as the National Audit Office showed, 30% reduction in spending over 8 years, and the only thing that's really gone wrong is Northamptonshire, and that's amazing, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you might have thought that was an opportunity in Whitehall to say, well, we should reward this sector, it's frightfully efficient, not a bit of it, so as Emily says. So, we'll soon arrive at a point where National Health Service spending will have risen more since 2010 than the whole of local government spending power for England.
Mm.
Okay? And the truth is, Martin hints this, or says it explicitly, it's interesting how far the Treasury and how far central government has not been able to think through to the logic that, given how inventive and how effective local authorities have been at managing these remarkable reductions to their funding, wouldn't it be better if they ran more at the local level and instituted a bit of decent financial management into creaking parts of the rest of the public sector at the local level, for which such things are, it would appear almost impossible. I mean, Emily made the point, brilliant point, that, would 20 plus billion extra be enough just to make good what's not going right now? No, probably not enough to do that and improve the financial management of the NHS.
No.
Well, that's not a great sign, is it? And I agree with that. So the inventiveness that's being shown and the increasing use of data management in councils, which I'm sure Simon Park would have been talking about, Redbridge is certainly doing this, to try to match, try to work out where the costs are and where services can be better and more effectively tailored to meet demand. If only the rest of the public sector were under the pressure that required it to do that.
Yeah. Martin, or Emily as well, all of what you've said is, and I agree with and is true, and we see this. So how have we in this position where local government on the one hand is kind of clearly a victim of its own success, there are clear failings or challenges at government level in dealing with something like local government, where it touches, as you were saying, 13 or 14 different departments and various budgets under that sort of stuff. Clearly effective financial management happening in local authorities, maybe less so in other bits of the public sector, and yet nothing really seems to change. Well, what's the kind of political, economy of the position that local government finds itself in vis-a-vis central government?
Well, this is where I have to speculate more, because the Institute hasn't done work. I think it would be a good topic for someone to do some work on. My sense, though, from my own career in central and local government and from other research I've done before the Institute, is that in the management of the relationship between central and local government, we're up against two quite unhelpful dynamics, one about the politics and one about Whitehall as a bureaucracy, professional machine. On the politics, as I mentioned earlier, local government doesn't have a Secretary of State voice at the table, really. The CLG, not for a variety of reasons, not functioning like that. Inevitably, national politicians are going to prioritise getting what they want to do and take credit for over the adequate resourcing of something that other politicians are responsible for and take credit or blame for. And then we get to some other unhelpful features in the management of the financial relationship. The multiplication of small bidding pots. So instead of handing over all such money as local government has in a single bucket that the skillful financial management we were talking about can make sense of, we have far too much handed over in small bidding pots. And of course, these are a very convenient way, particularly at a time of austerity, where there's the usual way, a clamour that something must be done for a Secretary of State or a Minister of State to be able to stand up and say, I've created a fund of £1.5 million, which will somehow solve this problem in 150 top-tier authorities. Now, the likes of us understand that that's nonsense, but I think it works for the media and the public because people basically don't understand the difference between £1.5 million and 105 million and... a billion and a half.
Yeah.
So there are these political dynamics that contribute to dysfunctional decision making about the relationship. And then, of course, managing spending in this way is also quite good fun if you're a civil servant. Rather than wrestling with difficult issues about how you structure a relationship strategically, so local government is playing its part in meeting national challenges, again, designing and delivering £1.5 million fund for, for school playgrounds or something is easy, relatively easy for Whitehall to do, and actually, as a civil servant, people I know would say it's quite fun. Actually, yeah. So that dynamic is getting in the way as well. And where we have seen breakthroughs to more sensible ways of mediating the relationship, which would include, for example, the Osborne era progress that was made in Greater Manchester and elsewhere. It's people have described it to me as being driven very much outside normal Whitehall and Westminster processes at the initiative of politicians who were convinced by it and found routes to bypass the default operation of the system.
I think that's right. Emily?
And I just think also, like, when we're talking about the politics of how all this happened, kind of thinking a bit historically, I think also at the other end, I think local government isn't only a victim of its own success, which it definitely is, you know, having made big efficiencies, but also in 2010, my sense is that there was probably quite a lot of the change that happened was welcomed, is my understanding. You know, the fact that, you know, a lot of the ring fences were removed, in terms of, central government, saying this money you have to spend on that, have to spend on this and this. A lot of that was removed. Also, a lot of the reporting burdens, which went from local government up to central government, kind of also went. With that went the data, went the ability of central government to understand what's happening in local government. And I think, for a while there was... So you had this culture of, great, now we've got our independence, okay, we're going to have a bit less money to work with it, but let's show what we can do. And I think that kind of... There was a culture, I think, of kind of not wanting to admit how difficult it was for quite a long time and kind of let things get to a point. And now I get wheeled out at local government things to be a kind of professional contextualiser, to say, okay, here's the story I can tell about what's happened to prisons. Here's the story I can tell about what's happened in hospitals. Oh, I can't really tell a story about what's happened to your services. It's much, much harder. And guess what? That makes it much harder for your argument to kind of reach the top table when it comes to a spending review, when it comes to deciding who gets the money. And I think it's taken a while, and now I think local government leaders are starting to cotton on to the value of saying, how we're struggling. But I think that they took a lot longer than maybe NHS leaders, for example, or than is the culture in education, to kind of talk about the struggle that they're having. There was much more a culture of saying, we are coping, we are managing.
Coming on your own reflection, but just on that as well, Tony, I mean, is there a tension there between the way, national government thinks about or thinks through services and service delivery, as opposed to thinking about local government as an institution or a set of institutions? And is that part of the tension, in a sense? They try to break it down and say, it's a culture service or it's an environmental service, and that's why we have these 13 or 14 departments, rather than think of it as an institution.
But there's, I think it's two related things, one serious, one arguably more trivial. On the serious front, because local government is a set of services, it's quite possible, and I was talking to a civil servant, well-intentioned civil servant recently, who was saying, of course, we're trying to protect our service, libraries. you know, we will argue hard that local authorities should spend more money on libraries. Well, all 13 departments can logically argue that more councils should spend more money on their services. But so that's the serious point, that is, there's a sort of mathematical fault somewhere buried in that that idea, a sort of logical fault. But the one that I think is, I would say, a bit arguably more trivial but real is that, you know, we're talking about local government. Well, you know, local government, that's really going to get people marching in the streets, isn't it? So it's the National Health Service, doctors and nurses, or defence, the armed forces, versus local government. Now, even the word city, county and town is better, but once you get on to children's services or adult care for older people, or sweeping the streets, then you've really got something to lobby for. And I think the fact that local government is a sort of collective has these two effects. One is the fact that every single department in Whitehall can say we should be spending more on our service, and why not? But secondly, as a concept, local government isn't as easy to... And I think, actually, if I can go further with this, I think it's not an accident that the Home Office and Justice Departments, which are also, in a sense, collectives of services, they've been the biggest cut. They've been cut more in Whitehall than other departments. So the moral of this is, have a department where, in a sense, the title is a service that people want to spend money on.
Very good. And employs people that the public regard as a good thing,
yes,
rather than great bureaucrats.
Both the armed forces and doctors and nurses, and you're away, really.
And I'm not suggesting for a second that the reduction in public services or local services delivered by local government is a good thing. But going back to your point, Tony, you know, the reality of moving from weekly to fortnightly and whatever else, bin collection or potholes on the street or libraries that are now closed or parks that only open, you know, on the weekend, is that one of the ways that the role of local government or the significance of local government actually could be benefiting from it?
Well, I hope that, in a sense, that the public will, we, the public, will kind of make the link between all of these things becoming visible at the local level and the issue we're discussing today. But my very faint fear is the sort of our old friend the slow-boiling frog. That is, that as this is creeping up over time, you know, we're now 8 years into the 5 years of austerity, there are at least, I would argue, 5-10 to go. We're going to get the national debt down, as the Prime Minister said at the party conference. This is not going to go away. So, and you know, as I said earlier on, the government's trapped by its own multiple commitments and the fact that its own backbenchers, any 15 of them, can get what they want. So 15 of them want tax cuts. Well, I'm afraid Mrs. May's stuck with tax cuts.
Yeah.
So the difficulty looking forward is that we're like, it's like a fixed weather pattern, really. And councils, I think, ought to be able to say, look, these services, I mean, I think it's happened with adult care, it will happen with children's care, and they can point to these failures of local public services, which are, you know, becoming more and more threadbare monthly. One Welsh local authority is now proposing monthly refuse collections. Well, you know, eventually I think the public probably will make two and two into four.
You've all said it in various ways, so let's something must be done, notwithstanding the challenges. What is it? I mean, in the short and in the long term, I suppose. I mean, you talked a little bit about this. There's a set of questions around money and the nature of that money, whether it's plugging holes or whether it's actually part of an investment program. So there's you give us a sense of that. And then related to that, but slightly different, is the kind of reform agenda. You know, and from our point of view, from Centre for Cities' point of view, devolution is part of that reform, you know, agenda, as much as it is around how much money gets spent in different localities and all the rest of it. So just give us a sense as to, you know, where we are, short, long, you know, money reform.
I mean, there's a few options from here, right? There's a few options for how you kind of solve this problem. You can increase spending in line with demand and keep services as they are. As Tony just said, that's not going to happen. Austerity is very likely to continue. So you can raise taxes, which can't happen right now, but might happen. It feels like that's going to be part of the discussion. I mean, radical service reform, right, making services fundamentally cheaper to run, that's an option, but that takes vision and also it takes a long time. Might have been, you know, I mean, we don't have a time machine. I think in 2010, when everyone was less exhausted, it might have been easier to do then, to make some big changes. It's getting harder. And you know that it takes time, it takes money to do those things. So that's not a kind of short-term fix. One thing we haven't talked about very much, although you referred to it, is increasing use of co-payment, right? So one of the things that we picked up on in Performance Tracker this year is, over the last 8 years, there's been a kind of, in some cases explicit and in some cases not explicit and quite subtle, shifting of costs from government to individuals, not through the tax system. So, you know, we've got really explicit examples of that. For example, legal aid reductions means that more people are paying more for legal representation, for example. And then I think in local government, you've got examples that are kind of somewhere in the middle. So there's been increased charging. Mm-hmm. So you're much more likely to pay for your garden waste to be collected now than you were 8 years ago. What we're also seeing going on in that local government's doing that you don't really see so much in other public services is the use of volunteers, right? The number of volunteers now vastly outnumber the number of paid staff in libraries, for example, and that those lines crossed over about 5 years ago. And you're also seeing kind of entire services getting spun out to communities. I mean, libraries is again the one that people reach for. We also see parks going into community ownership, you know, with investment from the government, from local government maybe, to kind of get it going, but fundamentally it is going out there. And I think we're likely to see more of that. That seems to be the direction of travel, but what we haven't had is an explicit conversation about it. You know, the government hasn't said to us that this is one of the trade-offs that's being made, and I think probably we kind of deserve as the public to kind of be part of this conversation and decide whether we're happy to make this kind of trade-off. You know, where you have flashpoints is where it's even less explicit. So of course, one of the things that happens is when you close things, you get a lot of outcry often. Some cases you do, some cases you don't. When you close a court, for example, maybe lots of people don't notice, but you're shifting a cost there to people, victims, witnesses who have to travel for longer. Now, that we might decide that that's efficient. If that court building's hardly ever getting used, maybe it's reasonable for some people to have to travel longer. Maybe that's a better use of public funds. But I don't think really that's not being thought through strategically, and that conversation isn't being had very publicly.
Martin, money and kind of reform and how that, you know, and obviously you've been doing work on the spending review and thinking about, you know, what that is and how it's run, I think is very important, as well as the outcomes, but just looking forward.
Well, if Emily is content, forgive me for being a bit of process, and what we said in our spending review report was, one, the government needed to make sure that a strategic look at the future of local government and resources for it was a central element of the spending review. So not the residual that I described earlier, but the spending review is an opportunity for the government to develop and indeed promote the debate with the public that Emily was talking about the future functions and funding of local government. Secondly, we said that the government should put some process in the spending review that enables it to test this proposition that bringing local public services together and applying some of the lessons that local government has learned about financial management, whether that could release value in public services. So, of course, people, the listeners to this podcast, will be familiar with the course that we've been round before in terms of total place and community budgets.
Yeah.
But for goodness sake, let's have a revisit of that, a revisit that may be justified given the implications of austerity, which may have changed some of the dynamics. But at least to test the proposition that whether over the next few years, government should embark on a fundamental reform of the accountability for the resources and activity in local public services, in which local leadership has a stronger part. That applies to services and revenue spending, but I would argue also it applies to capital assets too, like land.
Yeah, Tony, we talked before about, you know, various things in relation to the way, for example, local government is organised, the way it functions, the scale of all of those sorts of things, devolution. Your thoughts on, you know, on that aspect of the reform agenda, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, you know, part of me always see as reforms, displacement activity, so I'm very wary of it. On the other hand, I do see the move to city, regional and combined authority government, if it could be made uniform across England, separate issues for Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland, then it would be easier at that point to imagine a more radical form of devolution of public services and their budgets within England, which might do two good things at once. One is to improve the consistency of the way they're run at the subnational level, but the other is allow this sort of bringing together of budgets to drive a far more efficient and effective use of resources at this subnational level. Now, you could do that in the, you know, mayoral city authorities as a start to try it out. We like pilots, after all, in Britain, in England. So we could do that. But I do think something will have to be done. We're kind of, as ever, in understandably, talking about the system we're in and the world that we're in. But of course, we're talking about a freestanding long-term problem, which is, you know, how to manage public finances in Britain, alongside a country that's going through an extraordinary experience, which has nothing to do with that, which itself is going to make us stop and think about the entire nature of the country, its government and its institutions. And it is a moment of reflection, I think, for the United Kingdom about, you know, what kind of country it is and will be into the future. And should it be the most centralised large democracy in the Western world? Well, I think not, personally. Mm. So we will get an opportunity, potentially at least, to have that discussion. And I think we should. I think we've sort of a bit over agreed this morning that we should. But I think, in fairness, and, you know, Emily and Martin deal with Whitehall more than I do, but I think most people in Whitehall can understand all of this, but they feel trapped as well. I mean, it's interesting to, it's easy to, I always feel surprised how trapped people inside central government feel. I've said also, it's as if somehow our super powerful Whitehall machine is being run by somebody else, because they all feel trapped. They can't do things they want to do.
Yeah.
Very odd.
Martin, Emily, a reflection on that, but also how do we break out of that trap? And I suppose a question back to you then, Tony, would be, you know, what does local government cities, I mean, what do they do need to do themselves in order to, you know, to help make the case, to win the argument, you know, and to achieve the reform that they need, given that, you know, there is a sense within Whitehall in different bits that, you know, they kind of get it and they would, you know, they would do things differently if only if. You know, it seems everyone is waiting for everyone else and therefore no one does anything. But I mean,
I think Martin will give you the kind of the big picture on this. I have something kind of, I just have one very small thing that would help. And I look towards quite a kind of short time horizon, I suppose. And one thing is, so as I've said, a real problem is that we don't understand what the consequences have been. We can't have a national conversation about this because we don't have a proper understanding of actually what's happened in terms of bins. You know, how many libraries have shut? Actually, that's one we do know. How many parks have had their opening hours shrunk? We don't know that. You know, how much has street cleaning frequency been reduced by? We don't know that. Now, these are things that I say we don't know at a national level. Every single local authority knows exactly what's happened in terms of all those things, and it has numbers on it, which they use as part of their day-to-day business, right? This data they collect as part of business as usual. Now, we don't want to return to the bad old days of, you know, having hordes of people having to sit filling in, you know, hundreds of spreadsheets to feed the Whitehall beast. That's not what it's about. But if there could be, and there is some movements in this direction, but if there could be more movement towards local authorities agreeing to collect and store the data that they use and generate as part of their day-to-day business in a standardised way, as you know, they just agree particular data standards, that would then allow us to pull that data together and aggregate it really quickly. And if that was driven from the local level, not imposed from the top, I think that could really help the conversation, at least, if not kind of do anything more practical. Mm. Because obviously where that data is of most practical use is at the local level to make for local decision making.
Very good. Morning.
Well, I think local government needs to, I'm sure is, from my contacts in LGA and elsewhere, I'm sure is developing a strategy for the spending review, which is about not just about woe and misery, but also a positive view about how not only could the spending review alleviate local government's problems, but could play a part in solving the very fundamental challenges of the spending review as a whole. But at the risk of being slightly pessimistic, I think that the although there's much that the local government sector can do for itself, the initiative for this does have to come from central government and quite profound changes in behaviour and attitude. Another worrying process point that emerged from my research for the Spending Review project was that Whitehall and the Treasury in particular appear to be becoming more closed to conversations with operational public services, not least local government, at a time when open dialogue, exchange of ideas, problem-solving approaches to problems are needed more than ever.
Mm.
Tony?
Well, I can see that, you know, just picking up that thought, one of the reasons that Whitehall departments probably are becoming more closed is will be a mixture of, you know, they've got this one other big thing to do all the time, but tangled in with, they probably don't want to hear as much of this stuff. It's all because, you know, they'd be forced to try to think of what to do about it. I mean, one thing that, you know, listening to Emily and Martin today, you know, it's very clear to me is I can see why the Audit Commission was abolished. The Audit Commission, had it continued to exist, remember it was a body with an explicit remit to look at quality of management, the quality of services, to produce data about all of this, it's very data driven. Had it not been abolished, it would be producing reports today which would be profoundly embarrassing for the government. Mm. And I didn't realise at the time, but I can now see what a fortuitous decision that was in terms of where we'd be today. Now, in fairness to a whole range of organisations, we've, you know, been nice to the IFG and rightly so, the Institute for Fiscal Studies is doing more work on this. We've mentioned the National Audit Office, the Office for National Statistics is somewhat improving its, particularly its city-based yep. data. CIPFA, of course, partners with the IFG on the performance tracker. So a number of institutions and organisations, the Centre for Cities here, obviously, doing good work in giving us some of this information or some information that allows us to have an informed debate. But what there can't be, and I completely agree with Emily on this, is a sort of deep understanding of the impact on local public services of the thing we've now been discussing for about an hour, which is this remarkable degree of pressure on council budgets over a long time. And by the way, at a time when, you know, separately, devolution has been growing as a public policy objective. But, you know, we're often in the position, and I've made this point before, big cities are, you know, being encouraged, incentivized by various things like keeping Section 106 and community infrastructure levies, new homes bonus, business rate retention. These are all incentives, really. But there's a slight risk that they found themselves in the position of, you know, filling up a bucket of water where the bigger, the more water they put in at the top, the government drills a bigger hole at the bottom. Mm. And that is not, I mean, it's still an incentive, but it's not a great incentive. Yeah. So I think that in terms of good government, if you just, you know, stand back from all of this, what we're discussing is a dysfunctional approach to what isn't just cities, counties, local government. It's part of our democratic system.
Yes.
This is an the only other thing apart from Parliament and the, you know, Scottish, Welsh and Northern Irish and parliaments and assemblies, the only part of our constitutional system that's elected with that legitimacy. And we're, you know, effectively saying it's being weakened and is not being given resources to function properly. So beyond all the public service reasons for having local government, there are good theoretical democratic reasons as well. And going back to the, you know, the particular condition the United Kingdom finds itself in today, these are things we need to think about in a much more, in a much broader way. This is a national moment, and you know, it can either end well or badly, and I personally prefer well.
I think that's a good way to close. My guests today have been Tony Travers, Emily Andrews and Martin Wheatley. Thank you very much for being part of City Talks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.